Services. It is Monday already, July 7th. I hope everyone had a happy Independence Day. And I noticed that Rosie and Rosette are facing this way today for some reason, and perhaps they're looking this way, trying to encourage the members of this committee that if you make any slip-ups, that they're waiting to be fed. Probably hope too many people didn't have ribs over the holiday. But if you did, Rosie is probably feeling the pain from 4th of July.
Uh-huh.
How about that?
That's cute. Yeah.
We're hearing today House Bill 2349, a bill that's relating to patient safety. And it is a public hearing, and waiting for Mr. Britton to come up because he probably has some words of wisdom for us as well as some sign-up sheets. Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just to give you a little bit of an overview of the week ahead, today, as Senator Winters said, we're going to be working on House Bill 2349. We'll have a public hearing tomorrow. Some federal grant application requests. On Wednesday, we'll do a preliminary work session on the Department of Human Services Seniors and People with Disabilities budget. And on Thursday, Department of Human Services Health Services. We'll start with the public health components of that cluster budget and start that process. I also handed out to you a staff measure summary and fiscal impact statement on House Bill 2349A engrossed, as well as a copy of the bill. So you have all of those. And with that, one other thing. I did receive a letter from Aaron Kelly Seal, who is the health policy advisor to the governor.
If you will, and then I'll enter it into the record at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Kathleen Haley. Why don't I call two at a time? Gwen Dayton, why don't you come up, Gwen? You can come up and join Kathleen. I didn't know we had. Welcome to the committee.
I don't know how you could have had a better season.
You may proceed, Kathleen.
Madam Chair, could Ms. Winters, Ms. Dayton, proceed first because she can give you a general outline of the bill.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairwoman Winters, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. But I'm speaking today as a member of the patient safety work group that developed this bill. What we thought we might do, if it meets your needs, is do a run-through, essentially, of the bill, let you know what's in it, answer any questions that you might have about the substance of the bill, and then we can get into other issues that have arisen from folks outside the work group regarding the bill. So as I indicated, this bill is a product of a work group that was formed to look at the issue of patient safety, and in particular patient safety reporting as a method to both to analyze patient safety in Oregon and hopefully ultimately improve patient safety within the healthcare realm and improve confidence among consumers in the quality of care they receive when they do receive medical care. This was a broad-based work group that was composed of consumer representatives, representatives of healthcare purchasers, representatives from the state health division, as well as providers. And the actual representatives on the work group are listed in the handout that I prepared today. I won't read them to you, but if you can see that they are quite broad-based. Before getting into the actual legislation, we spent a lot of time figuring out what our real goals are with this. There's the obvious goal of reducing medical errors within healthcare. But what do we really mean by that, and how do we really think we can get there? That was a subject of much conversation, and ultimately we decided we want to reduce preventable adverse events by encouraging voluntary, confidential, and protected reporting of serious adverse events, promote a culture of patient safety. We want to analyze patient safety data to identify risk to patients, reduce the risk to patients by sharing information among healthcare providers to allow all of us to benefit from others' experiences, offer patient safety consultation and education to providers, increase public awareness and knowledge about patient safety issues, and undertake statewide efforts to improve patient safety. So with, and as another broad goal, build public confidence in participating healthcare facilities and providers' abilities to prevent serious adverse events. After developing that fairly ambitious list of goals, we looked at developing legislation itself. And let me tell you, before we get into some of the intricacies of it, what some of the big decisions were that we made before we really put any kind of pen to paper on this. The first question was whether or not, first, who the participants should be, and we'll talk about who those are. We talked about if we're going to have reporting, should it be voluntary or should it be mandatory? We talked about what level of accountability there needs to be for participants. What happens if they either don't participate in good faith or there's evidence of a medical error occurring in a facility? What do we want to do about that, if anything? So those are some of the significant decisions. As I go through, I'll talk about how you'll hear how some of those decisions were resolved. At the risk of boring you unnecessarily with the sunshine coming through the windows, let's go through this section by section. I think that actually will be helpful. In the first section, we developed definitions, which, as many of you know who have been around for a while, sometimes are really at the core of what a bill is all about. We defined serious adverse events to be objective and definable negative consequences of patient care or the risk of that are unanticipated, usually preventable, and result in or present significant risk of patient death or serious physical injury. And the term actually was revised to be serious adverse event pursuant to amendment on the House side. And then we defined patient safety activities and patient safety data. Those terms are important because later on we're going to be talking about confidentiality provisions in the bill. And it is these activities and these data that will be maintained confidential. Section 2 of the bill establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation as an independent corporation. Now, this was another significant decision that we made that I should have mentioned. What is the vehicle for this? Do we want entities to report to the state, perhaps to the health division? Do we want them to report to an entirely private entity? Or, if not those two options, what else could we consider? And in thinking about that issue, we ultimately, as a work group, decided the best option would be to report to this quasi-public corporation that we named the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation. This is an entity that is created in statute. It is given certain governmental powers. Hopefully, if we've done our job right, we have we've given them the power that they need, but also the protections that the public expects. For example, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but we have the budget being reviewed by the legislature and other similar oversight opportunities that I think all of you may deem important for a quasi-public organization. The corporation is to establish this system that I've been discussing, the confidential voluntary adverse reporting system to identify adverse events. establish quality improvement techniques to reduce errors and disseminate evidence-based prevention practices to improve patient outcomes. We also specify the ORS provisions that the corporation is subject to. That's important, frankly. We have to decide what will apply to this corporation and what will not. We made such decisions as deciding that the corporation would have the option of providing PERS benefits. That's one example of the decisions that were made there. We establish in Section 3, the Patient Safety Corporation Fund, and establish that we can accept funds from both public and private sources. And then Section 4 establishes the reporting program in the Oregon Patient Safety Corporation, and it describes the program. The program is meant to include reporting by participants of serious adverse events, and we discuss what those are, root cause analyses of serious adverse events. Root cause analysis is actually a JCO term for those of you who are involved in healthcare. It essentially means what caused it, what were the root causes of this error that occurred. Action plans to prevent similar future events, and then patient safety plans. The program also includes analysis of reported information to develop and disseminate information to participants to improve patient safety. That really is at the core of what this is meant to be about. This is meant to be an educational opportunity, not a regulatory hammer over participants. We want people to report and have the corporation analyze and disseminate in a manner that allows participants to learn and improve their own system practices rather than report and fear that they will be penalized for something that may have occurred. The program provides for auditing of reporting. We want there to be good faith reporting. We want this to be a meaningful program, so we're providing for an auditing of that reporting. There's overseeing of the action plans. We want to make sure they're adequate. They're not just paying lip service to the problem. They're really doing something. We're creating incentives to improve and reward participation. We're distributing written reports to describe statewide adverse event patterns. This could be good because we understand there is a need, obviously, among the public to understand what is happening with patient safety in Oregon, and so we expect this corporation to disseminate information publicly that, as we will discuss, won't necessarily identify a particular participant or a particular adverse event, but will let the public know what is happening with patient safety in Oregon. And also maintain a website public access to reports, as well as to a list of those facilities that are participating in the program. We want this to be something that participants want to engage in, and we want it to be a black mark, frankly, against them if they choose not to. So we expect that participants will be listed on the website, and somebody who is making a healthcare choice will know whether this particular hospital or whatever it might be is actually participating in the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Would you like to take questions, Madam Chair,
after
the presentation?
You can probably do it during the presentation because I think she stops for air.
I do stop for air, especially. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. As you've been speaking and going back to the definition of serious adverse events and I'm wondering what kind of discussion took place within the work group about some of the language barriers that exist out there in the healthcare professions now, and how those barriers can lead to problems, if you will. Can you talk to me about that subject and the place of that subject in this overall concept of patient safety?
The Chairwinter, Senator Gordley, we didn't discuss the language barrier. There are generally communication barriers broadly, specifically when we developed this bill. But your point is a good one, that there are many reasons why an adverse event may occur. Quite frankly, it is relatively rare for there to be a simple error on the part of an individual that they just do something wrong. Commonly, it's what we would call a system error. There's something about the system that allowed this error to occur. And I see the issue that you've raised of somebody coming to, for example, a hospital and having either perhaps a language barrier and the treating physician, for example, or nurse, not understanding necessarily what they need or what they're trying to say as a system problem. Because providers, of course, need to have systems in place to be able to overcome these barriers. And what we may see is that there are certain adverse events occurring either among certain populations, for example, or maybe even at certain times in the day that might be indicative of particular communication problems. I don't know. That's something that the corporation would develop and analyze and disseminate. Say, look, we seem to have a problem occurring at this juncture, whatever, or with this population, let's see what we can do to fix it. Because I see what you're raising as a system error that could lead certainly to adverse events.
Thank you. And just to follow up, Madam Chair, the overarching issue would be our capacity to provide health care interpreters or interpreters in the appropriate health care arenas.
Right.
And this, what you're telling me is that this is a way to track what our experience is out there.
Chairwoman, Senator Gorley, you raise a good point in the sense that I'm wondering in my own mind. Well, it would be interesting if the board may decide. We're getting to what the board of the corporation needs to decide. One of the things they may decide is they want reporting of adverse events based on population group, for example, so they can determine whether there, in fact, are significant barriers that are causing adverse events based on perhaps English as a second language, for example, or other barriers similar to that. They could decide to include that in the information that is reported to them so they can make that kind of assessment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Back in Section 2, I need a little more history. If the point of what we're trying to do here is educational and incentive-driven and not regulatory, why not form a federal nonprofit 501c blank, whatever, it's going to be a 3 or a 4, and enter into an interorganizational agreements with each of these groups?
Chairman Representative Smith, we did consider something like that. And the reason that we didn't was because we felt there was significant interest among the work group of having it run through the state. And so there's significant interest in having this be essentially a government program. And among those of us who were perhaps a proponent, and the Hospital Association, frankly, was one of them initially to run this through a strictly private organization, as you've described, we were convinced by others in the work group that there, and really agree, that there is a sufficient overarching public purpose to this, that there was a lot of merit to running it through something more like a public corporation. The public corporation was, frankly, a compromise between an entirely state-run program and an entirely privately-run program, and it's reflective of what we hope is, a reflection of the public importance of this and also hopefully a reflection of the benefit to the public of this kind of a program. But I do see your point.
Thank you.
We were talking about Section 4, and by the way, I do appreciate questions because it does help to clarify some of the decisions we made and why we made them. Section 4 really is part of the real core of this bill. In Subsection 2, it establishes that participation in the program is voluntary. And as I indicated, that was a subject of significant discussion among the work group, with some members of the work group wanting it to be mandatory. Ultimately, we decided that no program is truly mandatory if it's not a well-functioning program with integrity. And if it is a well-functioning program with integrity, we will get full reporting even if it's voluntary. So we ended up deciding that it's voluntary, but you will hear later that there are some qualifications to that. Eligible participants include hospitals, long-term care facilities, pharmacies, ambulatory surgical centers, outpatient renal dialysis facilities, and freestanding birthing centers. That was also the subject of much discussion. Subsection 3 provides that patient safety data reported to the corporation and information developed may not be disclosed to any state agency or used for purposes of any enforcement or regulatory action. That was very important for those of us in the work group, because we felt that if, in fact, a report of an adverse event could be turned over to a regulatory agency and used to penalize a participant, that there would be underreporting. And we don't want to see that.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you. Are we to understand that the emphasis here is on physical health and not mental health, or not inclusive of mental health?
Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, that that's a good question. At this point, the board will have the ability to develop a list of reportable events. And we did not develop that list. We felt that would be better done through rulemaking. But so the short answer is the list hasn't been developed yet. The better answer is my sense was that the focus is more on physical adverse events rather than mental adverse events. Partly because, and maybe this is unfair, but partly because one of the criteria that are very important to providers who participate in this program is that an adverse event be very definable and objective, and we know when it's occurred and we know when it has not, so that we have full and adequate reporting. Because I don't think you'll have good reporting if it's not clear when an event has occurred. So certainly I think our discussions were oriented around physical adverse events.
I'm thinking, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm thinking that those discussions may have been incomplete without a full discussion and inclusion of the mental health arena. I'm kind of taken by your statement that that was not on the list. I'd like to hear more about that.
Chair Winters, Senator Gordley, about why it wasn't on the list?
Yes.
You know, there's others that are testifying that may have a different answer to this, because I'm speculating about why something, we didn't discuss something. My sense of it is because when you look at patient safety across the nation, the kind of events that are reportable, boy, you never say always, that's always a mistake, but they strongly tend toward the physical adverse events. And we were looking at other states as we developed this.
Madam Chair, what I'm getting at is this. In your discussions as a work group, was there a conscious decision, a deliberate decision, to exclude mental health? That's what I'm trying to get
at.
No,
there was not.
Or did you have a thorough a discussion that said this is where we're going to start and there's a place for mental health, we're just not sure what it is yet, and as this whole entity evolves, we may get there? I'm just trying to get a sense of the place of mental health.
Yeah, Chair Winter, Senator Gordley, it really honestly wasn't discussed. But that having, we didn't make a conscious decision to exclude it, most certainly. But that having been said, if somebody was hospitalized and they were given an inappropriate dosage of a psychotropic drug, for example, and had a bad outcome, that would be an adverse event. Merely the fact that they're being treated for mental illness wouldn't preclude an adverse event from occurring based on, you know, something that happened with them, perhaps with a drug overdose.
Do you follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
Again, I'm just keying in on the entities, and that's the word in the bill, listed on lines 41 through 45 on page 3 and then continuing on page 4. That would be participants in the voluntary program, and again, the absence of mental health organizations.
Honestly, Senator Gordler, it didn't come up in a real specific manner.
Okay. Not okay, but
yeah,
I hear what
but
you're saying.
Yeah.
Gwen, are there other states that have such a quasi-corporation, and if there is, where are they?
Georgia, I know, Chair Winters, Georgia has a program that they run that's actually through a private organization. I believe, and I hope others will correct me if I'm incorrect in this assertion, that Vermont has a program quite similar to what Oregon has developed. But it is not the most common method of running the program.
So does the Hospital 2349 mirror Vermont closer than, because it is public quasi rather than private? Is that the distinction?
Chair Winters, I believe so, but I'm speculating. I'm hopeful that others with greater knowledge of that will add when they testify.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Does this bill grow government?
Chair Winters, Representative Smith, no, we believe it does not.
It'll have an executive director. Is that currently being done?
Representative Smith, yes, an executive director would be hired. But since we're talking about this, let's get into the funding of it. We provide in this bill that the funding for the corporation will come from up to 30% state funds. The up to is important because it could be zero. And frankly, the work group anticipates that it likely will be this biennium. And other funding for the corporation will come from grants that we can locate, and then the remainder will come from fees paid by eligible participants. So obviously, the up to 30% is in there because we do see this as a public good, as a public service that providers are see a lot of value in participating in, but we hope that the public also sees value in. We also understand that the budget this biennium is very restrictive and that it is unreasonable or perhaps unrealistic to think about public funds being dedicated to the program at this point.
Reverend Smith.
We all may agree that, you know, this has value, this is good, but the funding up to 30%, I think maybe a strain on our resources. I mean, if we are bound by any way to do that, and it's all well and good that they can go out and get private funding, would be even better. Also, in the staff summary or someplace, it said employees can now become PERS participants, correct?
That is correct, Representative Smith.
How is that not growing government?
In that sense, Representative Smith, you're correct, that if the corporation elects to participate in PERS, I am no PERS expert, but I've know enough from reading the paper that there is a budget impact from participation in PERS. But I don't believe the up to 30% direct appropriation binds this committee to appropriate any money. Obviously, providers would like some because we're paying the freight if the state does not, essentially, at least for the first few years. But we understand, we don't believe there is anything binding in this bill to bind you to fund anything.
Follow up.
Well, to me, if you're going to have an employee who can now receive PERS, to me that's growing government, kind of back from Malala, you know, where I guess we're just a bunch of old hayseeds, but to me that's growing government. Now, will this director have an assistant?
Chair Winters, Representative Smith, I don't know, and that decision is not up to me. It's up to the board when they hire personnel for this corporation.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. You know, we're just in real tight budgetary times, whereas I like this bill. I like what it's trying to do. Obviously, a lot of other people think it's much more important than I do. I don't think that we need to grow government and have more people on PERS or anything else at this point in time. And if this is going to be a privately funded organization, maybe they should have a 401k type of retirement for your executive director or something like that. That would be my only reservation. I won't even say objection, but a reservation. You know, this is how government grows. We start little, one biennium, and then we go on to the next biennium. We add a little bit more, and then we go on. We keep adding and adding and adding, and I never see anything or taken. We're trying to put a cap on something. That's my only concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Smith, I can see that. We talked about that in the work group, and mm-hmm. we elected to include the opportunity for PERS, not the requirement for PERS, so that we could retain perhaps existing staff from maybe the health division could come over and staff the corporation, and that was why, but I understand your point.
Is there, I don't see any budget numbers here in this packet. Was that because of not knowing what would be needed or required?
Chair Winters, I keep calling them the health division. I know they're called something else, but I'll never get it right. They developed a very general budget that I'm happy to share the numbers with you. They developed them the night, and I didn't, but I'm certainly happy to share what they developed. They felt that for the first year, the approximate cost to run the program would be $551,000. And the second year would be $651,000. And the year following that, year three, would be $768,000. And that assumes the hiring of an administrator, support staff, analyst, a pharmacist on staff, a physician epidemiologist, acquisition of computers as necessary, legal advice to the corporation, and the costs associated with the public health officer certification that we'll discuss in just a few minutes. And these, I know from talking to the state that they did their best to provide an educated judgment about what the budget would be, but that's pretty much what it is a sense of what this is going to cost us in the first few years.
With the exception of, I think, the pharmacist, most of the positions that you outline already exist within health services, and perhaps, Grant, are you in the audience? Can you come up a minute? I have two questions. One is whether or not the agency currently has the capability within its own resources to do something like this. You know, when they started outlining the positions, that's the first thing that came to my mind. And since this is some figures that you put together,
Chair Winters, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services Health Services, and we have been involved with this coalition from the start. And first, I would like to say that I really do appreciate the hard work that Gwen and others have put in, not only the Hospital Association but OMA, ONA, Pharmacists Association. We had insured purchaser group. We had consumer representation, state agency folks, and we helped get this jump started. But it really has turned into a process where there's a number of stakeholders that are really invested in this. But back to your question, Chair Winters, the answer is no. That within existing resources, we do not have anything that could come close to pulling off a patient safety corporation like the one that is described in the bill. What we have been saying is that we do not see this as having fiscal impact to the department and to my unit, because we have invested through other resources about one full-time equivalent staff person to be working over on this issue over like the last 9 months. We would continue to provide some level of support. I would hope that level of support, again, with existing resources to help move the corporation into an actual implementation mode. But we do not have the resources anywhere close to pull off the corporation as it's described.
Second question. Because patient safety and what happens in the health care environment, particularly, you know, the overarching picture of health care and its delivery, is there, and I know you're involved in helping put this bill and some of the pieces together, has the agency anywhere in the past have thought about having a patient safety a board or activity with inside the agency?
Chair Winters, we have recognized this as an important issue over the last 2 or 3 years, and I can't remember if Gwen said this already, but there was an Institute of Medicine report that came out a few years ago called To Err Is Human that talked about the cost that medical errors have to us as a society, both in economic terms and in regard to preventable deaths. And so with that report, there became a recognition on our part that this was a critical issue, and that's like why I say that we have invested over the last year what I think are significant resources to try to get this issue moving. So it is something that we want to see happen. We simply do not have the discretionary funds to be able to pull off much more than we're invested in right now.
Question.
I'll come back to Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on your question, did you discuss the possibility of integrating this into the Board of Medical Examiners? It seems to be a close nexus in the task of patient safety in that board and a possible expanded role.
Right. Chairwinter, Senator Morse, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, what's the best place to put this. I personally came into thinking, you know, this is something that we as a state agency, Department of Human Services, could do. Even having it that close to state government, there was a real concern from the provider side of things that it could become a regulatory punitive system, that there is that fear. And one of the critical elements here is that we need to have a reporting system where people are not fearing retribution, but instead are willing to report errors or potential errors so that those things can then be analyzed so that we can come up with best practices to promote across the system. And it really is looking at systems rather than individuals. So my concern, and it's really what I think the industry would say, is if it moves to the Board of Medical Examiners or even to the Department of Human Services, there wouldn't be that level of confidence that it would be a non-punitive system, and so we aren't going to get good reporting. That was on the one hand. On the other hand, the issue came up, should it be a independent, non-profit, private entity? And on that side, we had insurer, purchaser group representatives and consumers and state agency folks saying, you know, if that was the case, we're not convinced that it wouldn't be a fox guarding the hen house situation. We need to have that public credibility and accountability to make sure that this isn't something that is just going to be glossed over, but actually there is going to be serious work done on this issue and serious change being made in the healthcare system. And consequently, because there were there's two not opposing viewpoints, but two very different viewpoints, that's where the compromise came up of this public corporation. So it really is a public-private enterprise where we're far enough away from government that we really can encourage full reporting, but we're also close enough to government that there is that public credibility and accountability built in.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. You may have just answered my question, but I'll ask it anyway. I've just read through the entire bill, and to me it seems like we're a one-word amendment away from becoming an incentive-driven bill to a regulatory bill, and that is if you were to scratch the word voluntary out of this. And I guess, you know, it surprises me that the patient safety work group, and looking at all the list of members on there, don't share that same concern. If this bill has so much merit, why not strike the word voluntary? Why, if the work that would be achieved from this is needed, why not just say these folks shall do rather than voluntary?
I can answer that question as a representative of the provider community that was supportive of voluntary versus mandatory. And Chair Winters, Representative Smith, the reason that we felt it was important that this be voluntary is a couple of reasons, really. Some substantive, some to better express the philosophy, I guess, of the corporation. We felt that, first, if a program has merit, if it provides benefits to not only the public but also its participants, it assists them in their own public or patient safety programs, it provides strong evidence of best practices, for example, it provides a method for them to evaluate their own systems and move forward with quality care in their institutions, they will report. It doesn't matter if it's mandatory or voluntary, because hospitals and other healthcare providers are in the business of patient safety and quality care, and we will do what we need to do to meet that goal. If you make it mandatory, but it's not a program with particular integrity, or it's a program with strong regulatory hammer associated with it, you are still going to get there's still going to be a strong chilling effect on reporting. I mean, they'll be concerned about reporting, even if it's required, if you know that somebody's going to follow up with it on your report and indicate that you've, you know, and penalize you or indicate you've done something inappropriate, and it's not a learning experience. We felt that if we create a program that is, in fact, a learning experience and does provide benefits to both patients and participants, that we will have strong participation regardless of whether it's voluntary or mandatory, and you will have a better you'll get a better reception among the provider community if it's voluntary rather than it's one more regulatory burden on the provider.
I follow up. I guess the concern I have is, you know, the political winds change down here, and all it takes is a one-word amendment and your bill
becomes mandatory. You, Chair Winters, Representative Smith, you are absolutely right. And if you read further in the bill, we do have to report back to the legislature. And if there is inadequate reporting or there is not good faith reporting, the legislature at that point has the opportunity, as they always do, but it will be presented to them at that time, to make it mandatory. And so we know, as providers, we know that's a risk. And that's why we are wanting this to be as good a program as it can be, because if it is a good program with strong incentives to providers to participate, they will. And there will be no need to make this mandatory.
Kathleen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And as you're aware, the board has responsibility over the general practice of medicine in the state, and as such has had patient safety as its underlying mission since its inception. The board is neutral on this bill. However, based upon advice that we received from the Attorney General's office, we are requesting an amendment that clarifies that the board would continue to get the information that it currently receives when it issues a subpoena for patient records. And that is the extent of our involvement with this bill at this time, is to simply request this amendment to ensure that we continue our function. And I appreciate your consideration of that amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. If I may inquire here, related to your amendment, could you please comment on Section 11, Sub 1 and 2 of the bill, and how that relates to the amendment that you're seeking? The language that I'm keying in on here says that there would be established a patient safety data and establishes that patient safety data and reports obtained by a patient safety reporting program from participants are confidential and privileged and not admissible in evidence in any civil proceedings or subject to subpoena, discovery, or disclosure under state or federal public record laws.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, my understanding is that that is such that the reports that come out of this corporation about general data will not be accessible by entities such as the Board of Medical Examiners. But on the advice of the Attorney General's office, the thought was to be sure that the overall act does not preclude the board from getting its information as part of an investigation that may be part of the board's Oregon Board of Medical Examiners' work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wendy, do you have any additional comments to add?
Only very briefly, Chair Winters. The remainder of the bill essentially gives the board authority to develop the list of reportable events, essentially operate the program. There are strong confidentiality provisions in the bill, as Senator Gordley just indicated, but if you read it closely, you will read that certainly patient safety data that is reported to the corporation needs to be confidential. Otherwise, I think you'll have a strong chilling effect on reporting. But if you read it, you'll realize that we've said that nothing in this bill shall prevent anybody from getting what they already get. The Board of Medical Examiners has every right to subpoena the information they already can subpoena, just as trial lawyers and others have every right to obtain the information that they currently can obtain. So we tried hard to not diminish anybody else's ability to do their business as necessary with providers and medical information.
Okay. No one slipped up and paid Rosie.
That's sad.
That's very sad.
Has Gwen testified before the committee?
I think this is Gwen's first time in testifying before the committee.
Madam, please indulge me.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. When the purpose... Okay. You better be glad that somebody came to your rescue.
Thank you.
Oh, is there a fine?
I'm going to tell you that Rosie and her daughter are hungry. And when someone uses acronyms on this committee, they pay Rosie and her daughter, and they laugh. She doesn't like change, and she likes soft money, and it goes to feed the hunger in Portland. And
wait a minute, in the state.
In the state, I mean.
I said Portland.
I'm sorry. In the state. In the state, the Oregon Food Bank.
Well, then if it goes to support the hungry, perhaps I can give another presentation and I can invite others to contribute on my behalf if I use as many acronyms as possible.
Tell them to do better than Bernie because he only bought $1.
You bought two?
Okay. Thank you, Bernie.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And come back and testify before us again, and just don't forget Rosie and Rosette.
Okay.
I'll be glad to, and I'll see if I can and talk about all kinds of federal agencies by only their initials.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Before we get to the next person to testify, was the $551,000 for 1 year or biennium?
Chairwoman Senator Morris, that was for 1 year.
For 1 year. Thank you.
Scott Allen. And Barney, you can come back up here. Barney Spade. And then I have Ellen Lowe on deck.
Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and begin, if I may. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. The Medical Association has been intimately involved in the development of this bill and the choices that were made. The Institute of Medicine report was issued a number of years ago and was exceedingly controversial and is still controversial today. But what is not controversial is that medical systems errors do occur. And the fundamental issue is, are there statutory or legal barriers that inhibit providers, hospitals, other healthcare professionals from being able to gather information to identify why those errors have occurred and share that information so that you can, in fact, identify the problems that are occurring in one institution may be occurring in another institution or entity. This bill, in its structure, would enable institutions like hospitals or ambulatory surgical centers, some of which are owned by physicians, to be able to share that information without fear of retribution. And the bill was specifically designed to be a non-punitive structure where, in our experience at least, under peer review, the best data and information you can gather is from the voluntary participation of physicians and entities in the improvement of healthcare services. And that was the intent behind our development of this bill. Now, we had a number of principles, and actually Gwen has gone through most of those. But I'd like to maybe respond to a couple of things. First of all, I think the work group participants, including the health division, and we too want to thank Grant Higginson for his leadership in the development of this bill and making sure that the work group did its job and did its job well, essentially laid out a potential budget impact that may have some of you concerned. His the health division's or units estimates are done in two ways. One is a minimum for a two-year period is about $25,000, and the maximum is about $500,000 to $600,000 for 2 years. The practicality of this measure is that it would take approximately, in my estimation, a year to put together the very structure, appointments of the board, adoption of bylaws and rules and procedures before the entity actually began its earnest work in determining by priority which potential areas of evaluation and reports they would begin with. So the impact, in fact, would be exceedingly minimal from a general fund appropriation. If there was an appropriation at all. And I don't believe, actually, that it is very difficult to add language to the bill to make sure that there is a minimum obligation to the state over the course of the biennium, and we would be happy to participate in doing that. In regard to the confidentiality of the reports and information that would be reported to this entity or some other entity. Most, if not all, experts in this area believe that you absolutely have to have confidentiality in order to get the most significant information in order to improve quality care. And this bill provides for that and also recognizes that attorneys or others, licensing boards, disciplinary boards, would retain access to the same information that they receive today. The bill was amended at the direction of Representative Bates after discussions with Kathleen Haley to address her issue. It's a serious issue, but we believe the Ayn Gross bill currently addresses her concern. It's been reviewed by my counsel, by the counsel of the Hospital Association, and we believe that that language is already included in the bill. In regard to the issue of language impediments, the Federal Office of Civil Rights currently requires healthcare providers, physicians, hospitals, and others to provide interpretive services where it is appropriate, and they are required to pay for those services out of their own pocket today. As Ms. Dayton indicated, the board that is created by this bill could choose to investigate whether there are significant problems because of a shortage of interpreters, if they so chose. I would think, however, that there probably would be a prioritized list by the board in determining what they thought was possibly the most significant concern. For example, in the area of pharmacy, I think it's everyone agrees that medication errors are a significant problem. You can reduce by significant amounts of costs by improving prescriptions and how patients take those. There are significant language or understanding problems with patients in appropriately following the instructions for taking medications that could be reviewed and used to inform patients and the public about solving some of those problems and reducing those costs and concomitantly potential liability suits as well. We believe this legislation is very significant. We believe it's very significant in the participants who have their names as a requester on this bill. And I always do enjoy mentioning that it is highly unusual to see the three primary sponsors on the bill together, Representative Bates, Representative Cruz, and Representative Greenlick. I think gives you an indication of the breadth of the political spectrum of those who think this is a significant issue, as we do as well. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I have a couple technical questions. Will this new corporation be able to incur debt?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know the answer to that, but I will get you a response. It was not our intent that they would be able to.
I think that I have a few more technical questions, but I think that'd be something to look at because I assume the corporation's going to have a company vehicle or those type of assets that are going to need to be financed. And if you turn to page 7, line 17, it talks about that no funds will be expended by the corporation prior to approval of the budget by the board and the legislative assembly. The question I'd have is if this corporation incurs debt to purchase a vehicle or enters into a contractual agreement and a future legislative assembly is not as efficient as ours and goes into September-ish, how are they going to meet their monthly debt service? Question.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think, like you, we recently received a letter from the governor expressing some concerns over the current draft of the bill. Clearly, there may be some technical things that we may have missed, which we were more than willing, at least speaking for the Medical Association, more than willing to address, as well as to look at other potential options for lodging an entity of this type as well, again, to try to minimize concerns that you may have. But fundamentally, we still believe that this is a significant issue for not only the medical community, but the public, and that beginning the process of putting this structure together for full implementation is important to do.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, I probably, the tone of my question probably wasn't appropriate. It's more of a word of caution and rather than as a criticism. I do have one other technical question, though. In Section 11, it talks about exempting patient safety data, patient safety activities and reports from civil or administrative subpoenas, discovery, disclosure, et cetera. I need a little bit of legislative 101. How are we able to exempt data and reports from discovery or judicial disclosure?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, actually, you already do that under the peer review statutes. And what we did was model this language off of existing peer review statutes for confidentiality for the underlying data that is used specifically for patient safety reports. The information that someone would typically subpoena for a typical malpractice case or some type of litigation, again, the language specifically states that is, in fact, is still available. We intended that it be available. I have personally spoken with a representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. They have not indicated any objection or concern to me on this language to date. I've been around long enough to always be surprised that maybe from February when the bill was originally introduced to today, there may be some new one, but I'm not aware of any.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon Morris.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Gallant. I believe I heard you say that the board could look at the issue of interpreters in deciding, defining its priorities. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. The board, in fact, has, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, mm-hmm. The board has great discretion on determining what its priorities would be, but again, the first issue are adverse events, significant adverse events, and which priorities they might choose. You know, that could be, that obviously is a judgment call.
It is a judgment call. I would agree with that. And I think it's also a judgment that draws on whatever the life, personal, professional experiences of the people who are participating in the work group. And that leads me to ask about the makeup of the work group with an eye toward looking at what the makeup of the board might be if this policy moves forward. Were there any people of color on the work group, any people who had experience dealing with interpreter or language barrier issues? This is a huge issue in our state, mm-hmm. given the change in demographics, and there are implications for patient care. And again, I'm just trying to surface the issue as one that is important, and I'm trying to hear who had the conversation that has taken that brought us to the point that we're at now.
Correct, Madam Chair, Senator Cordley. I don't believe, my recollection is that no, there was not someone of color who participated in the work group. We did have a consumer representative who participated. The Oregon Nurses Association participated. The various participants as requesters of this bill, I think, is indicative of kind of the wide variety of participants in this area. Interpretive services are a significant issue. It's a significant issue for providers as well in being able to find interpreters making sure that patients and physicians and other providers are communicating clearly with each other. The cost of those services and where that burden falls is a significant issue as well. One that has in the last couple of sessions been a legislation has been introduced to have the state pay some of those costs. I don't believe that legislation ever made it through the process. But as a matter of federal regulatory dictum, essentially, providers are obligated to provide those services to the best of their ability.
And one of the questions we have right now, Madam Chair, follow-up, is what is the best of our ability look like out there around Oregon? And I'm not going to ask you to answer that, but I am going to ask you to think about that along with other folks asking for this, because I have serious reservations about our ability, our capacity to serve the different communities that make up our great state. We have some challenges.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would agree wholeheartedly that we do, in fact, have a capacity problem, and we'll be more than happy to give this serious thought and consideration and work with you or whomever in the future.
Thank you.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Other than the Board of Medical Examiners, how would this effort interface with current ongoing medical peer review efforts?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the peer review process would continue to operate as it operates today. Again, this bill addresses systems errors, not individual error or individuals who may have caused a medical mistake. So it's a different process, different system, and for different purposes.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Senator Cardi, Representative Smith. Let me get my...
I'll defer to handsome youth.
Ah!
Oh!
Wow!
You better go.
I better have a good question, huh?
Got that right. All right.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator.
G. Smith.
What was the rationale of leaving point F on your membership so vague? One representative of a statewide or national labor organization. How come we weren't able to further refine that a little further?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it may have been our lack of creativity.
Can you tell me just a little bit what your thought is in terms of how you see that position serving the corporation?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, for the record, Marty Speed, Kaiser Permanente.
If I'll try to field that, and to the extent that I'm not successful, Scott will have thought of something in the meantime. I did participate on the
work. A handsome young guy too.
Everybody looks more handsome than to me now. The makeup of the committee was a very serious deliberation by the work group, because we wanted to make certain, one, that the corporation, and two, that its board had credibility with the public. You'll see that we have two purchasers, because this is a serious issue among group purchasers, and one of them being the state, and the state is a major, or a governmental entity, is a major purchaser of healthcare through its human resources programs. Two consumers, two insurers. Again, insurers are very interested in seeing success in the area of patient safety. And the aspect of labor was added, I think, from two perspectives, Representative Smith. One is that labor is a constituency that is consumer-oriented, but equally important, there are labor management trusts and union trusts that are purchasers of care. So we and in many of the existing healthcare statutes, there is, if you will, a seat for a labor representative bringing their consumer perspective. But I also think, if I recall the discussions, that we were also very sensitive to the fact that labor trusts are, in many cases, very large purchasers of care and are equally concerned about the cost-quality-access continuum.
Go with that answer.
It's the best answer I could have come up with, Madam Chair.
Senator Carter. I'll give both of you the opportunity. In looking at Section 11, Subsection 1 and 2, you speak to the issue of patient safety, but also the issue of reporting and confidential and privileged information. But in the event that something happened to a patient that, for the sake of litigation, that this would then... The information is basically sequestered or unavailable.
Would you like me to respond?
Maybe I'm not phrasing my word right here. Let me see. Confidential privilege not admissible in evidence in any civil proceeding. Well, I just happened to be watching a television over the weekend of the 4th, and a guy was on who had a scalpel that had been left in his stomach and was very, very sick. And couldn't get anybody to go back in and do anything because nobody believed him. They thought the man was crazy, referred him to mental health. And I heard the questions you were asking while I was upstairs about was mental health ever a consideration in terms of information. But more than that, in terms of this data, in cases of that nature, what happens?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'll start, and my colleague from the Medical Association is a lot smarter in this than I am. But I would point first to lines 4, 5, and 6 on page 8, that the privilege that's established by House Bill 2349, the privilege of confidentiality for patient safety data, which is defined, does not reach to any records of a patient's medical diagnosis or treatment, or to records of a participant created in the ordinary course of business. So to elaborate on, I believe, what Mr. Gallant said earlier, that in the case of alleged medical malpractice, whether it be against an institution or a professional provider, then the patient record would be available to that patient, the patient's family, a legal representative of that patient through subpoena, and others who were involved in the ordinary course of the business, the treating physician, the nurse, others who were, if you will, around that event, would be deposable, and it is the intent of all of the proponents of this is that this bill will not get in the way in any way of any current medical legal rights that all participants have. I don't think that's too strong a statement. Then I would also point out, because it was an equal concern, and we continue to grapple to try to find the right language that makes everybody comfortable, but I would also point to lines 34 and 35 of page 8, where it says that nothing in this section should be construed to preempt or otherwise affect mandatory reporting under Oregon law. or licensing or certification, which is intended to mean, whether it be a hospital reporting through its licensure obligations to the health services section of the Department of Human Services, or to a professional licensing board that has certain reporting requirements, that this should not preempt any of that.
Thank you. You explained that very quick and good overarching. There wasn't a second question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do have a question. And that's on the minimum. I want to go back to funding. And in your testimony, Mr. Gallant, you said that a minimum of general fund appropriation of about $25,000. Is it possible that that could be even less than that?
Madam Chair, actually it could be, in my estimation. I will leave your staff with the Department of Human Services fiscal impact statement. I believe because of the lateness, which we've all noticed, of this particular session, that probably the minimum appropriation for the first year, which I again believe would be primarily the organizational putting the organizational structure of the entity together, the estimated cost in their documentation minimum was, I believe, $11,000. So, yes, I think there is flexibility on the number. It's possible to do it lower. But I again believe that it is important that we begin this process because for the reasons I've stated previously.
You also mentioned in your testimony that there was almost 20 states, and we had heard earlier there were two, and you said there's almost 20 states that have adopted some form of reporting mechanism, and were they evenly split, more public-private or more private-public joined together? What has been the makeup of those?
Madam Chair, there is quite a variety. I can get you a list. I'm not sure that my memory serves me well to give you a specific breakout. I think it's fair to admit that this is the choice that we made is a fairly unique choice, one that we believe worked well with the participants, and we think, in fact, addresses the public policy issue that this bill addresses. Again, there may be other alternatives, given the concerns expressed by the governor, that might use an existing entity. But those discussions hopefully can still occur. I think we have some time with the administration this session to resolve any concerns that have been expressed in the correspondence you received today.
Since you brought up that issue, and I will go ahead and pass out to the members. I do have a letter from the governor that I want to enter into the record, where the governor, actually it's from Aaron Kelly Seals, his policy advisor for Health and Human Services, raises some concern. And so I'll put the question back to not only you, but the individuals who worked on this legislation, whether you are amenable to sitting down with the governor's office and try to work through some of the concerns that were raised by Ms. Seals.
Madam Chair, for the record, Scott Gallen with the Oregon Medical Association, we most certainly are willing to meet with the administration, Aaron, or whomever, to iron those out at their convenience.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yes,
also? I think, again, I can't speak for the others who participated, but as one participant, I would look forward to such a discussion. One, to try to clarify the reason that we chose a public corporation, and two, to try to address any of the concerns, particularly technically, that the governor may have. But I think the interesting issue here was the attempt of the work group to try to find balance. My intuitive reaction to the question you posed to Mr. Gallant about the other 20 states is many of them, I won't say most, but many of them chose a more regulatory route, which was of deep concern because there's some early indication back that maybe they're not all that successful. This model, and you raised the question, Madam Chair, I wanted to address it, is that this model is probably 80% of what Vermont created several years ago in the Vermont Corporation for Healthcare Quality, which was a public-private organization that included institutional and professional providers, insurers, the state, et cetera. Its mission was much broader. It wasn't patient safety. It was actually created before the patient safety movement, if you will, came about. But it was, I've always been intrigued with the model because it brought government and the private sector together in the right way and gave, I think, good credibility to the public that its actions, its reports, a feedback loop, et cetera, had credibility. It wasn't a, if you will, a handmaiden of a provider group or a provider industry.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you the same question because I know you were part of the work group, and I know that Ms. Lowe was also part of the work group. If those who were part of the group are interested in having additional dialogue and discussion and work with the governor's office to resolve some of the problems that are pointed out by the governor.
Sure, absolutely. We've been waiting for a while.
Okay. And I see a yes from Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair. It would also, at least from my perspective, be very helpful if you or maybe a member of the committee might actively participate in that.
Thank you, Mr. Hi. Thank you, Senator Moore.
As if you...
thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question is, why not change the focus of the bill and make it a private corporation, but just allow the provisions of the bill to play out with respect to how the corporation's to function?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think that's a legitimate issue. It is, again, as Ms. Dayton mentioned, one that we had discussed before. That does not mean that it's completely off the table. I think we may ultimately at this stage of the game be in a political dilemma that we may need to resolve to hopefully all parties' satisfaction. And that may be one option. I'm not specifically aware of exactly what direction the administration may be willing to go, but would be very interested in resolving that.
Madam Chair.
Reverend
Scott, do you have questions?
Nope.
Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. I've had the opportunity to read the letter from Aaron Kelly Seal. And I would just point out to Mr. Gallant and Mr. Spate that on page 2 of the letter, which you may have had the opportunity to scan as well. Do you have the letter?
Madam Chair, Senator Cordley, yes, I received it at 1.
Well, I want to point out a particular thing that just gives me pause, given the discussion that we've had here today. It says in paragraph 1 that House Bill 2349, as drafted, contains numerous exemptions from certain provisions of state law that are unrelated to that mission. For instance, the OPSC would be exempt from the affirmative action requirements of ORS 243.305.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would like to respond.
Please do. I
recognize that we as drafters may have made some technical errors, which in my opinion are easily fixed.
Madam Chair, may I also add to the record on that? And I'm glad you raised this issue, Senator Gordley, because in the discussions we've had prior to the bill being printed and subsequent to its printing, the work of the work group relative to what ORSs would apply to a public corporation and what would not was, in fact, there was a great time commitment to get the bill drafted, and there was an acknowledgement that it was not a careful review.
Let
so
me
any,
read further.
But Madam Chair,
I'll cut you off. But let me just read further. There's another statement, which is the last sentence. some of the more inexplicable exemptions in House Bill 2349 are exemptions from the prohibition on sexual orientation discrimination and from the ban on smoking in public buildings. I understand that you were in a hurry, but, you know, this is just unacceptable.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Gordley, I concur with your reaction to this. All I can point is that the intent of the drafters was not as it seemed. Now, I would also like to, if I may, Madam Chair, respond to Senator Morris's comment about a private corporation.
Let me respond to what you just said, Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Earlier, I made a comment about the importance of who is in a room, who's participating in. I asked a question and some clarity around who was participating on the work group. This is a perfect example of what happens when a work group or any public policy making group isn't inclusive. We end up making this kind of omission and this kind of error, if you will. And it's the kind of omission and error that just can't be glossed over, and let's move on to the next subject. That's why I'm staying on the point.
I appreciate the fact that you are, Senator Gordley.
Thank you.
And if I may, before I respond, the issue of culturally competent care, which is the issue that you raised in another context, for the reasons that you may have cited, were not openly discussed in the meeting because of the nature of the discussion and perhaps our own shortcomings as individuals. I would point out in the bill, however, on page 2, that the reports are to include, and this is shall include, demographics of patients involved in serious adverse events. I think that's a very important, and I'm not going to say that that saves us, the drafters, but the demographic bases of these reportings are going to be very important to get at this issue of culturally competent care in a changing Oregon demographic. And it would be my expectation, based upon the nature of the dialogue in this legislative session, that the board should be very cognizant of the importance of those demographics and be able to investigate serious adverse events that have demographic biases, whether they be cultural, whether they be linguistic, racial, ethnic, whatever. So let me make one final comment, because and it has to do with the issue of a private sector bill. I suppose if you look at the names of the organizations that requested this bill to be introduced, and we came in with a private sector bill that was not a public corporation, there would probably be some very legitimate criticism of what we were really trying to do. We tried to find balance in this bill of the public-private approach because of, one, the sensitivity of patient safety. And what's really going on in American healthcare, but Oregon healthcare specifically, is that we're all working extremely hard to try to eradicate the culture of blame that's in American healthcare and move to a culture of openness and reporting adverse events or near misses, as they sometimes are called, so that we can get at the systems problems, because most human error in healthcare is not unlike, and this is modeled after what's gone on in the airline industry for over a decade. They're systems problems with people involved in them. And if we can find out that the underlying problems of systems related and cure those, the system will work more efficiently, less costly, less harm to patients. The culture of blame in American healthcare, though, runs deep. And in Kaiser Permanente, what we're trying to do, we're actually setting goals, and this may sound counterintuitive, of how many reports of patient safety incidences have we had in the last quarter, and are actually trying to increase the number of reporting. And our nursing staff, our labor management partners, and others kind of look quizzically, but the only way you're going to break the culture of blame is to get those who are involved in patient care and in the systems of patient care to feel comfortable with that and to not take it as a personal indictment of them. whatever, and that we get behind this. So the again, my closing comments on the bill: it tries to seek balance. It's not perfect. We look forward to working and the legitimate criticism that's been given today. But I agree with what Mr. Gallant said. I think this, from a policy perspective, is a sleeper bill for this session. I think it's an important step forward, and I also think that it's been crafted in the Oregon tradition, which I take some pride at, that notwithstanding the shortcomings that have been pointed out here, rightfully so, we did try to get all the parties around the table and deal with a sensitive topic, and it took us 8 or 9 months to do it, and there's more work to be done.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do want to make one other comment about the governor's letter. Technically, trying to reach all of the appropriate statutes is very difficult. It's our error in missing that. If we had been informed sooner, either by my counsel or other counsel, that we had specifically missed these specific statutes, I might be accused on the smoking ban piece. We would have made those corrections immediately, or they would never have been in it to begin with. I only had one person point out the smoking ban to me, which I was aware of. But the other sections I was not, and again, please accept my apology, but it was very complicated to try to put this together.
Ms. Long, do you want to come up and add your testimony to this? And I know that you gave the yes nod when I asked if everyone would be agreeable to get everyone to regroup and have some conversation and look if we can't do something. I do think that it is very important that we begin to really work on this particular issue. I know one of my physicians here in my community, who is the president of the Marion Polk Medical Society, has raised this issue and the need to have a vehicle to where you can begin to get at the errors and omissions and some of that in a way to where the medical profession was feeling, as you say, not having the guilt hammer over their head and not having to deal with it in a blame environment. And so I think it's one that patient care and to be able to get at some of the systemic issues does have some value, but I think we've got a little more work to do on this particular bill. And with that, welcome, Ms. Lowe.
Chairman Winters and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today without portfolio. I did serve on this committee as the consumer representative, and you have my written testimony, but I think as a result of some of the questions, there are some of the things that I would like to raise in addition to what I have provided to you. One is that I also served on the, can't remember the exact name of the medical professional liability task force, the malpractice one. And it became very clear to me after the first meeting that I wasn't going to be able to do a lot, just as you as legislators have not been able to do a lot about some of the malpractice issues and the disagreements. But there was one area where I really needed to spend some time, and perhaps it's my background on the Health Services Commission, and that's prevention. And so that if we really did begin to look at system errors, at medical errors, perhaps we would be able to lessen the number of adverse events that really precipitate some of the real needs of patients for remedial care, both financial and medical. And so I entered this particular discussion really looking at ways so that Oregon's healthcare system could be more efficient. And you have heard about today from some of the providers about their need to be able to trust the system. The consumer also needs to be able to trust the system. I'm quite convinced that your confidence as you seek medical care is perhaps one of the best prescriptions that is there for you as a consumer. And so I see an effort such as this as being able to build confidence on the part of consumers that the healthcare providers in Oregon are indeed trying to do their level best to improve the system. And as you begin to look at some of the literature on this, it's amazing how many of the errors really are system errors. It isn't so much an individual making an error, but it's the culture in which they operate. And so I am one of those who came in thinking that it probably should be a public entity. But I became quite convinced in listening to the providers that their ability to participate with confidence of all those folks who worked for them would be enhanced by having a voluntary system, and that would be a public corporation. And so some of you have raised the possibility of a private one. Wearing my consumer hat, I really don't see the public having as much confidence in something that is totally private. And I also came to fully recognize that the providers feel just about the same about a public entity. And so I do think that we will be able to build a partnership that will work. We did look at some of the literature from Vermont. We looked at what was happening in some other states where it was mandatory, and the participation was less. Providers who do not participate in a voluntary system are going to be pretty visible. And so I really think that you will see all the major ones participating with confidence that this is going to work. The other concern that I brought as a consumer was the whole confidentiality issue. I think we've worked it out in the law. As I read the letter from the governor's office, I was surprised by some of those omissions. But public corporations, we don't have very many in Oregon, and so coming up with the list, I can fully understand that the drafters had some difficulty in making sure that those were appropriate for the culture that we call Oregon. And I regret that we're now in July, because in February was when we had to submit this. But I think there's time, and I really do need to say that I don't think this should be an interim activity. I think that if the governor's office is willing, that I'm quite convinced that all of us on that work group would be willing to sit down right away and work something out, because it's in the best interests of those who need health care in Oregon. It's in the best interests of providers. And good health care costs less. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. And I want to thank all of you for your testimony today. And I will be getting back to the group, and I will have some conversation with Aaron Kelly Seals, the governor's office, and see if we cannot quickly try to resolve some of the issues and some of the problems. Is there any additional testimony on House Bill 2349? If not, tomorrow we will hear a grant application and the federal grant application request for safe practices. See, we're talking about safety here today, and we're going to talk about safe practice and implementation of a challenge grant, improving child welfare outcomes through systems of care. If there's no further business for today, we are adjourned.